Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. Kenyan warplanes have attacked targets in neighboring Somalia days after gunmen from Somali militant group Al-Shabaab killed 148 people at a Kenyan university. The Kenya Defense Forces says the airstrike Sunday targeted two Al-Shabaab camps in the Gedo region of southern Somalia. Kenya Defense Forces spokesman David Obonyo said Monday the two camps were destroyed. Resident of the Gandan Dawe area told VOA that the airstrikes killed livestock and destroyed houses, but said residents have not seen any human casualties. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta has vowed to respond to Al-Shabaab's attack on Garissa University College in eastern Kenya. Pakistan's parliament opened a special session Monday to discuss Saudi Arabia's request for the government to join its military coalition against Iranian-backed rebels in Yemen. Ayaz Ghul has the story.
Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif convened the session because political rivals and civil society groups are increasingly against Pakistani intervention in the Saudi-led conflict in Yemen. In opening the debate, Defense Minister Khwaja Asif did not say whether the government has made any decision on what role Pakistan intends to play.
In response, the Saudi leadership expressed appreciation for Pakistan's unreserved support to Saudi Arabia's territorial integrity and expressed the hope that Pakistan would join the coalition for Operation Decisive Storm by contributing aircraft, naval vessels and ground troops.
Tens of thousands of Pakistani soldiers are engaged in counter-terrorism operations near the border with Afghanistan. Ayaz Ghul for VOA News, Islamabad.
This is VOA News. Following up on that story, fierce clashes raged in southern Yemen between Shiite Houthi rebels and forces loyal to the country's president as the Red Cross faced delays with urgently needed aid deliveries. Medical sources say more than 50 people have been killed in Aden in the past 24 hours. U.S. President Barack Obama says the framework agreement to curb Iran's nuclear program in exchange for sanctions relief is the best bet by far to keep Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, in an appearance Sunday on NBC's Meet the Press, continued his outspoken opposition to last week's agreement, saying it leaves Iran with a vast nuclear infrastructure that will ultimately result in nuclear weapons. Mr. Obama described U.S. defense of Israel as unshakable, seeking to provide reassurance while negotiating with a country whose top leaders have denied the Holocaust and expressed a desire to destroy Israel. Prosecutors and defense lawyers are presenting their closing statements at the trial for accused Boston Marathon bomber Johar Tsarnaev. The focus of the agreements is whether he will be executed for his part in the April 15, 2013 attack, which left three people dead. He was also charged in the death of a police officer who was killed 3 days later. If the jury finds Tsarnaev guilty, he will then hear evidence to decide his punishment. The defense argues Tsarnaev was an aimless college student who fell under the domineering influence of his radicalized older brother, Tamerlan, who died following a gunfight with police 4 days after the bombing. Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi says his government will work with Kurdish authorities to liberate the northern province of Nineveh from Islamic State militants. Speaking Monday in Erbil, Mr. Abadi said the governments of Iraq and Kurdistan face a common enemy. Iraqi Kurdistan President Masoud Barzani, who spoke alongside Mr. Abadi, said both sides have agreed to form a committee of military and security experts to see how the collaboration will work. The two men did not lay out a timetable for the plan to retake Nineveh. Malaysian authorities have arrested 17 people, including two who had recently returned from Syria for allegedly plotting terror attacks in the capital, Kuala Lumpur. Police Chief Khalid Abu Bakr said in a Twitter message Monday that the 17 were arrested Sunday, gave no further information about that. The arrests come after the Home Ministry proposed two new anti-terror laws last week that will reintroduce indefinite detention without trial and allow the seizure of passports of anyone suspected of supporting terror attacks. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiyu Suhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
You're aware of a total of three different days. It looks to me like five different incidents starting the 3rd of April, Friday. The total for the 3 days is 1,760.
That was Joel Milman, spokesperson for the International Organization for Migration. Italian Navy and Coast Guard ships rescued over 1,700 migrants over the weekend who were stranded in vessels off the coast of Libya. We'll have full details coming up.
Also in the news, Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta has vowed to respond to Al-Shabaab's attack on Garissa University College in eastern Kenya.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour: Kenyan warplanes have attacked targets in neighboring Somalia day after gunmen from Somalia militant group Al-Shabaab killed 148 people at a Kenyan university. The Kenyan Defense Forces say the airstrikes yesterday targeted two Al-Shabaab camps in the Gedo region of southern Somalia. Spokesman David Obonio says the two camps were destroyed, though he did not give a death toll. A resident of the Gandon Dawe area told VOA the airstrikes killed livestock and destroyed houses, but said residents have not seen any human casualties. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta has vowed to respond to Al-Shabaab's attack on Garissa University College in eastern Kenya.
Italian Navy and Coast Guard ships rescued over 1,700 migrants this past weekend. Authorities said they received distress calls from three vessels in trouble in the Mediterranean off the Libyan coast. On the way to the rescue site, they found two other foundering boatloads of migrants. The migrants were taken to Sicily or Lampedusa. There is no word on their condition. Italian officials say the number of migrants making the treacherous Mediterranean crossing to Europe has soared in the first 3 months of the year compared to 2014. Joel Milman is a spokesperson for the International Organization for Migration, IOM. He spoke with me about the rescue operations that just took place.
We are aware of a total of three different days. It looks to me like five different incidents starting the 3rd of April, Friday. The total for the 3 days is 1,760. We are told that some of the boats were Coast Guard, were picked up by the Coast Guard. We are told that 318 arrivals were picked up by an Icelandic ship that was participating in Operation Triton, which is the Frontex European-wide border patrol effort. And I'm not clear on two boats that were picked up Friday with a total of 394 migrants. I don't know if that was Italian Navy or Coast Guard.
What countries were the migrants from?
Well, the biggest, as has been the case lately, is Nigeria. Also, quite a lot from Eritrea, the Horn of Africa. Also, Ghana, Niger, Senegal, Togo, Mali, Mauritania, Palestine. We heard Pakistan mentioned, Syria, Morocco, Sudan, and Somalia were also represented.
You mentioned a number of women and children were rescued. What is their condition?
Don't really know. We haven't heard of any deaths, which surprises us because usually when the numbers are this high, it's a little bit late in the year for hypothermia to be an issue. So we haven't heard of anyone who is pregnant, although that often happens. We would know more, you know, after this holiday weekend and we get more reporting then.
Officials are saying that a number of migrants making this treacherous journey across the Mediterranean to Europe has soared in the first 3 months of this year compared to last year. Do you know why that is?
Well, we know deaths have soared. We know there were only 46 the first 3 months of last year. There are already 486 the first 3 months of this year. I'm told the absolute numbers are pretty close, that the numbers of people who have made the crossing, not extraordinary, but the numbers who've died is extraordinary. I don't know, except for the variability of weather. You know, we had a week in March where 4,300 people crossed, which is almost half of this year's total, and the weather conditions were excellent that week. The prior week, we had 300 people died, including 29 who were rescued, but then died of hypothermia because it was just so cold on the boat that they were brought onto. And the boat wasn't of the right scale to offer enough protection against the element, and they actually died. So why it's deadlier now has a lot to do with what kind of weather they crossed in. And we are growing to understand that the conditions in Libya itself have a lot to do with why these ships take off. I mean, people maybe wouldn't risk a dangerous crossing if conditions in Libya were safer, but during a really tough period where there's a lot of gunfire and a lot of violence, people might be taking risks they shouldn't. I mean, these aren't things we can really nail down. It's just intuitive, but that seems to be what we're learning from the survivors.
So these are people who were from other countries in Africa, but were living and working in Libya and then trying to escape from Libya.
That is frequently the case. They're also finding that also frequent are people that arrived very recently in Libya. Now, did they come to work? Did they come to go to Europe? You know, your guess is as good as mine. You know, Libya has been a gold mine for employment for the rest of Africa for quite a long time now, and it continued to be, even during the uprising against Gaddafi. And we realized this, that Senegalese and Togolese and Burkina Faso residents, people that are showing up now more and more on these ships to Europe, not really part of the traditional West Africa to Europe migrant route. When we talked to them, and I was in Africa last month, had a chance to talk to a bunch of people who were rescued off Tunisia in the middle of the month. A lot of them would be happy to stay in Libya and do the work they do if conditions permitted. But the crime has gotten so bad that they have to leave and they grab these boats. At the same time, you also meet people that are fleeing Boko Haram in Nigeria. They mentioned cities in northern Nigeria where conditions have gotten really bad, and they say they were in Libya only a few days. So clearly they came looking for a boat to get to Europe.
Those people that were recently rescued over the weekend, they will be processed then in Italy, and will they be allowed to stay there?
It's a whole range of what happens in Italy. Some people managed to melt away. And last week, there was a former NATO airbase dependent quarters, you know, basically looks like a U.S. housing development. And it was full of West Africans, and some of them have been staying there months. They're winding through a very long and difficult bureaucratic process to determine what's going to happen to them. It's a place that is available to all kinds of migrants, although we didn't see anybody from Syria, for example. And we know lots of Syrians are arriving, and they clearly were not in this compound. They may be somewhere else in Italy going through the process. They may have already left Italy.
That was Joel Millman, spokesperson for the International Organization for Migration. He spoke with me from Geneva.
Egyptian officials say the leader of the militant Islamist group that claimed responsibility for yesterday's bombing of a bridge in Cairo has been killed. A policeman died and seven others were wounded in the attack on a checkpoint in the capital's upscale Zamlek district. The Interior Ministry says they shot and killed Hammam Mohammed Atiya, the leader of Ajnad Misr. The terrorists have been attacking police and military positions in other parts of the city. Various armed Islamist groups have been attacking government checkpoints in Cairo and in the Sinai Peninsula since the ouster of Mohamed Morsi, who was elected president of Egypt in 2013.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Swuhib, 15 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta has vowed to respond to Al-Shabaab attack on Garissa University College in eastern Kenya. And Egyptian officials say the leader of a militant Islamist group that claimed responsibility for yesterday's bombing of a bridge in Cairo has been killed. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
In Nigeria, Boko Haram militants reportedly attacked the northeastern village of Kwajafa yesterday. The French news agency quotes witnesses as saying militants killed about 24 people, but the figure could not be independently confirmed. Witnesses also say militants set fire to homes, burning half the village before they left. Kwajafa is in southern Borno state, one of three Nigerian states to bear the brunt of Boko Haram attacks over the past 6 years. Joint forces of Nigeria, Chad, Niger, and Cameroon have claimed major victories against Boko Haram in recent weeks. But analysts warn the group may now launch more hit-and-run attacks.
Three of the leading advocates for children's education have written an open letter demanding the release of 200 Nigerian schoolgirls kidnapped last year. April 14th marks the one-year anniversary of the abduction of the girls from the northeastern town of Chibok. Joint Nobel Peace Prize winners Malala Yousafzai and Kailash Satyarthi have joined with UN Special Envoy for Global Education, Gordon Brown. They've sent the open letter to Nigerian President-elect Buhari and other international leaders. The letter says leaders should keep up the fight against Boko Haram and create safe schools. This week, a 7-day remembrance of the girls' kidnapping begins with vigils, marches, and demonstrations.
Despite a decrease in deadly attacks, Cameroon says suspected Boko Haram fighters have been seizing food and livestock from farmers and cattle ranchers on its northern border with Nigeria. As Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from Naoundé, most of the food producers are now relocating to safer areas away from the border.
The governor of Far North Cameroon, Midiyawa Bakari, says the armed insurgents carry out raids in groups of 5 to 10, seizing cattle, food and money from residents along Cameroon's border with Nigeria's Borno state. He says Cameroon's very long and porous border with Nigeria makes it possible for the insurgents to attack crop farmers, cattle ranchers and small businesses and quickly make a getaway.
Les bêtes se sont retrouvées en divagation. Personne ne pouvait aller là-bas et ça fait des milliards.
Sally Daru, a member of the National Assembly from Northern Cameroon, tells VOA some of the farmers who refuse to cooperate with the assailants have been killed. But the governor says the inability of Boko Haram to organize a major attack on Cameroon for more than 2 months now is an indication they are finding it very difficult to regroup themselves in Nigeria due to the offensives carried out by the new regional military force with troops from Cameroon, Chad, and Nigeria. He says he is very sure Boko Haram will be terminated soon and that today everyone can see that the end of the terrorist group is near. The last major attack by Boko Haram on Cameroonian territory was on January 10, 2015 at Fotokol, when about 300 assailants killed 500 people. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Last week, retired General Muhammadu Buhari defeated incumbent Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan in national elections. It is the first presidential defeat for the People's Democratic Party, or PDP, since military rule ended in 1999. Contributing to the win of General Buhari and his All Progressive Congress, or APC, was support from the country's southwest. The region had voted for the PDP in many elections in the past. Kabiru Mato is a lecturer at the Department of Political Science at the University of Abuja. Reporter William Eagle asked him about some of the factors that influenced the outcome of the polls.
Well, it's not precisely correct that the Yorubas have been voting for PDP. Yes, they did vote for PDP in 2003. They did vote for PDP in 2007 and even in 2011 to some extent. Yes, that you can say. In 1999, they did not vote for the PDP. They had Alliance for Democracy. But you see, so many factors are responsible for this. The poor political brinkmanship of the Jonathan administration, which in the last 6 years, or in the last 4 years to be precise, has absolutely excluded, you know, the southwestern part of the country from the mainstream of, you know, the Nigeria's political economy. And for every Nigeria's political own watcher who understands the nature of mix within the Nigerian Federation, will tell you that the southwest is the most sophisticated section of the country as a result of, you know, they are very high mobility as far as education is concerned. They are grabs of the national economic, you know, infrastructure. And so for any political administration to try to isolate them within the framework of, you know, Nigeria's political economy will be committing a suicide. And I think precisely that is what the government of Goodluck Jonathan did. And that precisely has also angered, you know, the Yoruba elite and the Yoruba nation, who woke up between 2011 and 2015, to find that the government is absolutely being run without adequate representation from that very fluid and mobile section of the country. So I think more than any other thing else, the politics of exclusion of the Goodluck Jonathan administration, which in my view was deliberate, but was also a political, did contribute tremendously in perhaps directing the focus of the Yoruba nation towards a new alliance, which, of course, you know, has resulted in the coming of the government of APC at the center.
Where does this leave the idea of the rotation of the presidency between different regions of the country, an idea that was popular for several years but seemed to fall out of favor around 2010 or 11 as President Jonathan ran for election?
Well, you see, the idea of rotation is an extra political, political consensus by the major political parties in Nigeria. It's not a constitutional issue. It is convenient because it helps a lot in reducing the tension and the feeling of alienation, especially from certain sections of the country who will see it as impossible or likely impossible for them to produce a president of Nigeria in the event that such, you know, a zoning or rotation arrangement is not put in place.
Where does this leave the ruling or the former ruling People's Democratic Party, PDP? Where does it go from here?
The major issue within the PDP is that they possibly have taken Nigeria for a ride for a very long time. The imagination that they've been in control of political power since 1999, and they kept telling us at every opportunity that they are the largest political party in Africa and that they are going to rule Nigeria for a period of 60 years. Unfortunately, they're mistaken 60 for 16. PDP has become synonymous with corruption and impunity. A lot of Nigerians really, you know, have not been happy with what is happening. And I think there is a national resolve that things should be done right. An effective political leadership be put in place that will be able to provide that leadership and discipline that is required in order to propel the nation into the next stage of development. Otherwise, Nigeria will continue to remain backward and even move backward in a time or a time when other nations are making progress. The PDP is not a natural political party. It is an amalgam of very strange bedfellows that came up in 1999 and then captured political power, 1998, and captured political power in 1999 and ruled the country. And the degree of instability within the party for the last 16 years in itself is sufficient reason why it should find itself in the current crisis that it is in today. So the PDP really is down, and it will take a long time for them to be able to possibly get their acts together
and then bounce back to the mainstream of Nigeria.
That was Kabiru Mato, a lecturer at the Department of Political Science at the University of Abuja. He spoke to reporter William Eagle.
The World Health Organization reports Liberian health officials are monitoring more than 180 people who had contact with a food vendor who died of Ebola on March 27th. There have been no new cases confirmed since that date. Heightened vigilance is being maintained throughout the country. Liberia was nearly declared Ebola-free when the food vendor fell ill. More than 4,300 Liberians have died of the virus in the past year. That's the highest number among three West African countries hard hit by the year-long epidemic. In Sierra Leone, more than 3,800 died, and in Guinea, more than 2,300 died. In Guinea last week, 79 newly infected Ebola victims were confirmed. That's an increase over 45 new cases in the prior week. The 45-day health emergency remains in place for the prefectures of Forcaria, Koya, Dubreka, Bofa, and Kindia.
In the capital, Conakry, officials are limiting participation in burials to close relatives. All corpses will be tested for the virus during the 45-day emergency period. In Sierra Leone, 25 new cases were confirmed. More than half of the cases were people who were being monitored in the United States. The first health worker to contract the virus has filed a lawsuit against the Dallas hospital where she works. Nina Pham accuses Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital of poor staff training and improper preparation for handling Ebola patients. The hospital denies the charges. This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Yiswuhib in Washington. It's 27 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I'm Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America.
Next on Straight Talk Africa with host Shaka Sali. Good Luck Jonathan loses, but democracy wins in Nigeria. We'll look across Africa at the system of government where power is vested in the people. That's next. Right here on VOA Africa.
What's going on? What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi right here in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We love to have you on board. This is Upfront on The Voice of America. Hot, hot.
Upfront is a show that explores issues
that affect your daily lives. Don't move. Don't move that dial. Get your snacks. Get your cup of tea or your cup of coffee. Put your feet up. This is Upfront. Cheers, cheers. Clink, clink.
Yeah. Now there's a youth culture that is being practiced by the youth globally.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I feel like the problem is that once the funds are sent to these developing countries, it sometimes gets in the wrong hands, and then it's the actual people that are supposed to be benefiting from these funds really never even get to see.
What does this mean for your local culture? Is it being threatened? Should your parents be worried? Let's talk. This is Upfront of the Voice of America. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is at Upfront Africa. And remember, you can always send us an email here on the show. It's upfront@voanews.com.
This is a public service announcement from VOA Africa.
The battle against Ebola does not end when a patient survives the virus. I am Dr. Conde Greaves. Many survivors return home to their villages only to face stigma based on fear and ignorance. We must fight against stigma and welcome Ebola survivors back into our communities. They are no longer contagious and pose no threat to you. Thousands of orphan children also need your support. Imagine losing your mother and father to Ebola. Their tragedy is often compounded by rejection and isolation when they return home. This is wrong. They are not sick. We must welcome orphan children back into our communities. They have suffered enough. We must also respect our healthcare workers. Many have given their own lives so that others may have a fighting chance. Learn the facts about Ebola. Knowledge is life.
This was a public service announcement from VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Kenyan forces carry out airstrikes against Al-Shabaab targets in neighboring Somalia days after the militants killed 148 people at a university in southern Kenya. And three of the leading advocates for children's education have written an open letter demanding the release of 200 Nigerian schoolgirls kidnapped last year. Coming up, we'll have music from Burundi. And in our feature segment, the UN works on a new rapid response mechanism to counter the slow response to food emergencies. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehias Ruhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Happy Monday, Sunny.
Happy Monday, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you're beginning with U.S. college basketball.
Kim, let's tip off with U.S. college basketball. The finals in the men's and women's National Collegiate Athletic Association championship tournaments are now set. Ladies first in Tampa, Florida. The Connecticut Huskies will play the Fighting Irish of Notre Dame in a rematch of the 2014 final. The two-time defending champion Huskies bidding for a record-extending 10th national title won last year's final 79-58. In semifinal results Sunday, Connecticut topped Maryland 81-58, while Notre Dame edged South Carolina by 1 point, 66-65. Meanwhile, the men's final will be played later Monday night in Indianapolis, Indiana. The Blue Devils of Duke University, aiming for a fifth national title under Hall of Fame coach Mike Krzyzewski, will play the Badgers of Wisconsin, who won their only trophy way back in 1941. In semifinal results over the weekend, Wisconsin defeated previously unbeaten Kentucky 71-64, while Duke beat Michigan State 81-61. Now, that scoreline didn't sit well with former Los Angeles Lakers star Magic Johnson, who was in attendance at Lucas Oil Stadium in Indianapolis. Magic was cheering for the Spartans of Michigan State. Our VOA basketball fans will remember Magic led Michigan State to the national title in 1979 when he and the Spartans beat Larry Bird's Indiana State team 75-64.
They're playing basketball. We love that basketball.
In pro basketball, Indiana Pacers star Paul George has made a successful return to the court. His first action since breaking his right leg August 1st. George scored 13 points in 15 minutes Sunday night to help the Pacers defeat the visiting Miami Heat 112-89. With the NBA's regular season winding down, the Pacers moved into a tie with the Heat for the number 9 position in the Eastern Conference. Both teams trail the Boston Celtics by one game for the conference's 8th and final playoff spot. In Texas, the defending NBA champion San Antonio Spurs snapped the 12-game winning streak of the Golden State Warriors. The Spurs spanked the visiting Warriors 107-92. Kawhi Leonard, the most valuable player in the 2014 NBA Finals, matched a career high with 26 points for the Spurs, and Leonard set a career high in steals with 7. In Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, the NBA's top two scorers had a showdown. James Harden scored 41 points to lead the Houston Rockets past the Oklahoma City Thunder 115-112. Russell Westbrook scored 40 points for the Thunder, and he also had 13 assists and 11 rebounds. In basketball terminology, that's known as a triple-double, double figures in three different statistical categories. Cleveland Cavaliers star LeBron James also had a triple-double on Sunday. LeBron tallied 20 points, 12 assists, and 10 rebounds to lead the Cavs to a 99-94 victory over the visiting Chicago Bulls. In football news, Portuguese star Cristiano Ronaldo exploded for 5 goals Sunday as Real Madrid trounced Granada 9-1 in a Spanish La Liga match. Gareth Bale of Wales scored the opener for Real, and then Ronaldo tallied 3 goals in an 8-minute span to decide the match before halftime. He added 2 more goals after the break for his first 5-goal performance in La Liga. Ronaldo, the reigning FIFA World Player of the Year, has 47 goals in 41 matches in all competitions this season. Real Madrid remains 4 points behind first-place Barcelona in La Liga. Barcelona beat Celta Vigo 1-0 on a goal by Frenchman Jeremy Mathieu in the 73rd minute. Our friend in Lagos, Shagun Dot on the Spot Adeyemi, joins us now with some Nigeria football news.
Good evening, Africa. Stephen Keshi is yet to sign the new 2-year deal offered him by the Nigeria Football Federation, NFF, to continue coaching the country's senior national football team, the Super Eagles. Keshi has described the deal as, quote, a slave contract, unquote. This is because of the clauses in the contract that makes Keshi answerable to several persons and committees. Apart from the clauses, Keshi is required to meet several targets and also to sign a new code of conduct. Under the new deal, Keshi will be paid 5 million naira or less than $25,000 per month, the same salary he received during his initial contract. There is a continuing debate on whether Keshi, who is 52, should be given a new contract after he failed to qualify the Super Eagles for the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations hosted by Equatorial Guinea earlier this year. His initial contract of 3 years ran out after the 2014 FIFA World Cup in Brazil, at which Nigeria reached the last 16, where it was eliminated by France. Olakan Wogu is a football enthusiast and a senator-elect from Rivers State in southern Nigeria. He asks the NFF to be decisive on Keshi so that Nigeria football can move forward.
I think these negotiations with Keshi has been on for a while. Sometimes you need decisiveness. Okay, if his era is over, so be it. We need to come to terms with that reality and move on. Every day you hear Keshi is looking for a job in some other country, and you can't have divided loyalty. Coaching the Nigerian team cannot be an afterthought. So it's either Keshi is on or he's not. But if he's on, then he has to give his all and give us the results. If he's out, then let's realize he can't just keep waiting for somebody to make up his mind.
That was Olakan Wogu, a football enthusiast and a senator-elect from Nigeria's Southern River State. He spoke with reporter Tony Tamuno in Port Harcourt. Finally, athletics. Ethiopian runners won the men's and women's events at the Daegu Marathon in South Korea on Sunday. Gurime Behanu won the men's race in 2 hours, 7 minutes and 26 seconds, the second fastest winning time in the history of the race. On her part, Meselet Melkamu clinched the women's title in 2 hours, 27 minutes and 24 seconds. It was the third time in 6 years that Ethiopia had won both races in Daegu. For both athletes, it marked the second marathon victories of their career. Thanks so much for listening. For the Sunny Side of Sports, this is Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
Hello, this is Haile Gebrselassie. You are listening to the Sunny Side of Sport on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
The VOA's Daybreak Africa sportsman, Marco Uma, has more sports news for us.
We begin with volleyball. Egypt's El Ahly are the new Africa Women's Club champions after beating Kenya Pipeline 24-16, 23-25, 25-20 and 28-26 in the final played in Cairo, Egypt on Sunday. Earlier on in the bronze medal playoff, Egypt's Sham edged Tunisia's Carthage 25-17, 31-29, 20-25, 17-25 and 16-14. Algeria's GS Petrolia is fifth, Rwanda Revenue Authority sixth, Uganda's Vision 7th, Cameroon's FAP 8th, ARSU of Seychelles 9th, and Ingies of Cameroon 10th. Kenya Commercial Bank is 11th, Botswana's Kutluano 12th, and Senegal's Soltig is 13th. Consequently, El Ahly have earned the ticket to represent Africa at the World Women's Volleyball Club Championships in Belo Horizonte, Brazil, scheduled for October. In rugby, England beat South Africa 21-14 in the final at the IRB 7 series in Tokyo, Japan on Sunday. Argentina outclassed Kenya 17-12 in the Shield semi-final. At the end of the seventh leg of the nine-leg series, South Africa lead the standings with 129 points. Kenya is 13th with 33 points, while Zimbabwe is jointly 16th with 1 point. In football, hosts Seychelles face Egypt, Ivory Coast and Nigeria in Group A at the inaugural Africa Beach Football Championships. According to the draws in Cairo, Egypt on Sunday, Group B features Ghana, Madagascar, Morocco and Senegal. The six-day contest starts on the 14th of April in Victoria. The finalists qualify for the FIFA Beach Soccer World Cup in Portugal in July. I'm Mark Omer in Johannesburg, South Africa.
This is Africa. Zamina, mina, waka, waka, Zamina, mina, sakalewa. This time for Africa.
I'm very, 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 very excited. Ngichabulile.
Hola. Because this is Africa. Zamina, mina, waka, waka, Zamina, mina, sakalewa. This time for Africa.
The Sunny Side of Sports welcomes your comments. You can send me email at sunny@voanews.com. Sunny is spelled S-O-N-N-Y. And pick up a pen or a pencil and a piece of paper. My full postal mailing address is The Sunny Side of Sports, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue Southwest, Room 1613, Washington, D.C., 20237. So drop me a line when you get a chance. I appreciate the feedback. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's The Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahaeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to The Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of The Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on The Voice of America. Well, despite early warnings, aid agencies have been slow to respond to food emergencies. Part of the problem is a complex procurement system, lack of contingency funds, and overall bureaucratic slowness. Is it time for a different model? Well, the UN is working on a new rapid response mechanism. VOA's Gabe Jossel reports from Nairobi.
The United Nations says more than 260,000 people were killed as a result of the famine that struck areas of Somalia in July 2011. The regional director for the United Nations World Food Program, Valerie Guarnieri, tells VOA that while the warnings were issued months in advance, the response was not enough to avoid catastrophe.
In Somalia, the sense was that while there was some alarm bell ringing that was happening earlier in the year from WFP among them, that the alarm wasn't sounded loud enough and sort of clearly enough to facilitate that kind of response. So the response only came after the famine was declared. And that's really just, it's unconscionable. It's just too late.
A report from Oxfam and Save the Children released in 2012 after the Somalia crisis had subsided said one reason for the slow response was that raising money for humanitarian efforts too often depends on media and public attention to a crisis. The evidence for that is in the data. Figures provided by the United Nations show that donors contributed $342 million to the Somalia appeal in July and August of 2011 after the famine was declared, which is more than the total funding received during the first half of the year. Guarnieri says in the past it could take up to 3 months to convert funding into food, but that with new planning techniques, the UN has sped that process up to 2 weeks. Still, she says one of the problems is that donors want to see their money in action, like food dropped from an airplane. But by that point, the crisis is already in full swing. It is sometimes hard to convince them to support contingency plans instead.
There's an understanding that a pledge made as a forecast allows us to move faster, but there's also always a desire when you make a contribution to then, after your contribution, see that tangible assistance being delivered on the ground. So we're trying to address what are some sort of donor visibility issues.
Early warning systems take into account some of the expected indicators of crisis: malnutrition, harvests, food availability. But the UN is also working on better predicting political problems to give agencies a jump on potential emergencies. Guarnieri says political mapping is more art than science at this point, but that agencies are using the system to plan for Burundi, where political tensions have been on the rise ahead of elections in June.
We've been working as the UN and supporting the country team to develop a contingency plan for Burundi in the event that the upcoming elections result in displacement or conflict beyond just a sporadic incident. We're working with government as well on that plan, and there's going to be a simulation in the coming weeks where we start to test some of the assumptions of the plan to really see how ready we are.
Despite lessons learned from past emergencies, contingency planning and funding still remains a huge challenge. The most recent data shows that in South Sudan, for instance, where agencies have been warning of the possibility of famine for months, a UN humanitarian appeal for $1.8 billion has received less than 8% of the requested funding. Gabe Joselow, VOA News, Nairobi.
For decades, South Sudan was known for producing some of the finest honey in the world, but years of neglect, insecurity and conflict crippled the industry. Now, beekeeping is on the rebound. Mugume Davis Erawakaringi visited some beekeeping villages to find out why.
As you enter Eastern Equatoria State's Bora village, about 150 kilometers from Juba, the sound of insects and birds can be as overpowering as the sweet fragrance of the ever-flowering plants that flourish as far as the eye can see. Various pink, purple, and yellow wildflowers brighten the brownish-green savanna vegetation even during dry season in Bura. That is one of the reasons it is known as the Honey Village. Travel about 4 kilometers deep in the bush near Bura, and you see pots, hollowed-out tree trunks, and traditional beehives hanging in trees alongside modern ones, including four belonging 32-year-old Jacob Okela. In 2008, Okela was collecting firewood in the forest when he saw bees in a tree trunk. The sight gave him an idea.
In the bush, when you get a good tree, you cut that tree, you burn inside the tree. And then you bring the tree, and then you put in the group. The bee also, they come and enter in that beehive there.
He eventually made a traditional beehive using bunches of sticks. And with that, his beekeeping career began. With the help of an American NGO, Okela formed a beekeeping group whose members were trained to maintain modern hives. Okela says you have to be patient. It can take as long as 4 weeks to attract enough bees with honeycomb or sugar to form an active colony.
You put it inside. The bee also, they need sweet things. And then they come and enter in that beehive there.
Okela earns at least 2,400 South Sudanese pounds per season from the raw liquid honey he extracts. That pays the school fees for his four children. There's another dividend for beekeepers. They consider young bee larvae a tasty delicacy.
Honey itself is a nutritious food. It contains natural minerals and vitamins which help metabolize so-called bad cholesterol and fatty acids. It is also used to prevent infection and kill bacteria. Eugenio Oboya from Parjok Payam says he has been keeping bees for more than 4 decades.
My father was a beekeeper, a traditional beekeeper, and I used to go with him out to harvest, to side the hives, and to do our activity related to beekeeping. So I developed a liking for that from my early childhood. Yeah.
How old were you then?
I was about 10 years old only.
And how old are you now?
Oh, I'm now 73.
Okay, and you love what you're doing?
Sure, I love it so much anyway. Yeah, I love it really.
After several trips to Kenya and Uganda to observe beekeeping practices, Oboya now makes an improved wooden beehive for easier harvesting.
The frames are typically of the Langstroth hive, and the front part is the brooding chamber, the brood chamber, with a deeper sort of frame.
From the profits of his 11 modern hives, Oboya built a house, bought a motorbike, and sent his children to school. He thinks South Sudan should start producing high-quality honey domestically.
We are looking at processing the honey locally. That's what we would like to see here. Not that our honey is taken away and being processed somewhere else. We could do it here.
But beekeeping is not easy. Oboya says some beehives are destroyed by wild bushfires set by hunters searching for bush meat, while others are destroyed by red ants or monkeys who eat honey and bees. Matata Safi is a community development manager for Honeycare Africa, an East African company which helps farmers supplement their income through beekeeping. Safi says bees are also important because they pollinate plants which boost farmers' yields. Safi says since working here, they have recruited over 1,000 beekeepers in Western Equatoria, Eastern Equatoria, and Central Equatoria states. Last year, they exported 30 metric tons of unprocessed liquid honey to Kenya. Safi says honey gives South Sudan a chance to diversify its economy.
At the moment, the oil prices have dropped in the world market, and a country to only entirely depend on one resource, it is a bit catastrophic if there are problems that affect that sector.
In Magu County, honey dealer Bongomin Nelson sells honey by the roadside in 5-liter containers.
Tell us now, they become?
£10.
This is £10?
5-liter.
Okay. Is it good?
My tegol.
Okay, but is it good? De tamam?
Tamam.
Okay, let me test and see if it is tamam. It's good. Man.
For VOA News, Ajam Mugume, Davis Rwakarinj.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
There is a clear link between endemic corruption and violent extremism.
Corruption on a large scale often results in and from poor governance, leading to the root conditions that too often breed or give sanctuary to violent extremism, anger, moral outrage, and disaffection for a system or society that allows some to thrive through dishonesty at the expense of the rest. Where there is weak governance or a lack of quality education, economic opportunity, or respect for human rights, citizens are most at risk of being alienated by or from their governments and each other, noted Undersecretary of State for Civilian Security, Democracy, and Human Rights, Sarah Sewell. This is not just about ideological affinity. It is about alienation and anger that drives communities to align with or tolerate the violent extremists. Thus, ISIL in Iraq was able to exploit disillusionment with corrupt officials to garner support among some of the civilian population, not because they shared ISIL's perverse religious stance, but because both opposed the government. And in some other parts of the world, various violent extremist groups that sow chaos and misery have used corruption and the absence of good governance as a potent recruitment tool, as the Taliban has in Afghanistan. Other violent extremist groups have gained footholds or wreaked havoc in countries where the security forces have been weakened by endemic corruption, as Al-Shabaab has in Somalia and Kenya, or Boko Haram in Nigeria. Corruption is just one of the enablers of violent extremism, and efforts to combat it will need to be taken in concert with a number of policy and programmatic interventions if we are to stem the growth of violent extremism, said Undersecretary Sewell. This includes strengthening civilian institutions so they not only provide security, but provide legal avenues to hold elected officials accountable and respond to the needs of their citizens, ensuring inclusive governance to reduce political or socioeconomic marginalization of particular groups. It means building secure and resilient communities in which the vulnerable don't need to align with extremist groups to address their concerns, said Undersecretary Sewell. And it means weakening the appeal of extremist ideology by amplifying the voices of leaders who promote tolerance, peace, and diversity, and who speak out against violence against civilians. Violent extremists exploit public discontent with corruption to garner support. Thus, eliminating corruption is key to rolling back and marginalizing extremism.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Let's Talk. Join host Sunday Shomari and his guests discussing celebrities. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest with some hilarity. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm Linor Moudou. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Malaria kills thousands of people each year, but there are some simple things you can do to protect your family. If you can, put screens in your windows. A simple screen can keep disease-carrying mosquitoes out of your home. If you go outside, wear light-colored clothing and long pants and long sleeves, especially when it is dark and mosquitoes are most active. After it rains, empty all containers of standing water. The water in just one discarded tire can become a breeding ground for thousands of mosquitoes. Make sure your home is clear of debris and anything that holds water, including discarded cans, water containers, and rubbish. Empty containers that livestock drink from regularly so that mosquitoes cannot breed there.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.